parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and thank you for joining us for the 67th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would please let us know the name of the song, the artist, and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So that was an excerpt from a song off of one of Steppenwolf's later albums. It's a song called Snowblind Friend, which is obviously about a cocaine addict overdosing. And I thought that would be kind of an interesting entree to our part two. The saga continues. Our substance abuse dependency discussion.
Yes, fair enough. As Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is Addiction is Not a Disease Part 2, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so what I thought I'd do, since we talked about a couple of shows ago, artists who appeared on other artists' records, either anonymously or under pseudonyms or whatever, or just didn't, you know, they didn't get credited or whatever. So I thought tonight what I would do is talk about some famous songs that I suspect most of our listeners have heard and or know and or love. And they think it's written by the artist, but it's not. And so I wanted to talk about the songs and the real artist who wrote the songs, the songwriter, who often does not get credit for it except in the royalty section, of course, because that's who gets all the royalties from the song. So I'm going to start out with something that probably everybody knows, a very famous song called Feeling All Right, which has been recorded by a shoot tons of bands and artists over the years. Probably most people know either the Grand Funk Railroad version or the Three Dog Night version. The song is a written piece that was originally appeared off an early Traffic record, and it's written by one of its members, Dave Mason, who wrote that, and also the song that most people know by Delaney and Bonnie and Friends, Only You Know and I Know. That's also a Dave Mason song. So, moving on to a female vocalist, Bonnie Tyler, who has had several hits over the years, particularly in the 80s and early 90s. She's still touring, by the way. And two of her famous songs, Total Eclipse of the Heart and Holding On for a Hero, both written by the penman of the person that wrote most of the Meatloaf songs, Jim Steinman. So he's the author of those two. Yeah. And if you hear those songs, it's got Jim Steinman written all over it. If you know the style. Yeah, I mean, the first time I heard Holding On for a Hero, I went, oh, my God, this is a Jim Steinman song. I mean, it's just so obvious to me. But
that didn't even occur to me. Well, I used to do that one for karaoke when I competed.
Oh, there you go.
Because it's got a good
belting
bridge in the middle of it. Yeah.
Yeah, so you were singing Jim Steinman.
It didn't even dawn on me.
So moving on to a famous George Benson song, one of his very few top 40 songs, because he's mostly a jazz guitarist and known for that feel quite so, and he should be. He's a really good guitar player. But he had a song that became popular on the radio, This Masquerade, and that was not written by him. It was written by, and when I found this out, I almost dropped my drawers, Leon Russell.
Mm.
So that really shocked the crap out of me. He is not a guy that I would have associated with a song whatsoever, but, you know, what do I know? Leaving on a Jet Plane, a very famous Peter, Paul, and Mary song back in the day, written by John Denver. Manic Monday.
He's done a version.
Manic Monday, the Bangles song, written by Prince.
Wait.
Okay, so another Bangles song, A Hazy Shade of Winter, that's also resurfaced by Gerard Way off a new TV series. That's written by Paul Simon, as in Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, that one I did, though.
Right. And obviously Simon wrote The Sounds of Silence, which has been recently covered by Disturbed.
Yeah.
So that's also right. So the Tina Turner song, Private Dancer, very famous song for her, written by Mark Knopfler, Dire Straits guy.
Huh.
Yeah, I wouldn't have gotten that one either. I was like, whoa, because I thought that was a really kind of cool song and kind of jazzy, and I'm looking at the author going, holy moly. A Thing Called Love, made very famous by Bonnie Raitt, who's covered a lot of different people and along with writing her own stuff, and also a very accomplished live player, written by John Hyatt. Very famous Nashville writer. He's written a lot of really good songs. The Joan Baez cover, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, one of her most well-known songs besides Diamonds and Rust, which was covered by Judas Priest. Yeah, she wrote that. The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down was written by Robbie Robertson, as in the band, the guitar player for the band.
Yeah.
The Tom Petty song that he does with the Heartbreakers, Feel a Whole Lot Better. That's a Bird song written by Roger McGuinn originally. Tom Petty was an avowed Roger McGuinn freak, which is why he sounded like Roger McGuinn and why he played a Rickenbacker. I'm like, hello, clone boy. Not that that's a bad thing, but just saying. Okay, so Woodstock. The song Joni Mitchell wrote, which was made famous by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young off their second album. That's actually with Young, it's their first album. I take that back. CSN's second album, CSNY's first album. Joni Mitchell wrote that. Also, a Joni Mitchell song, Both Sides Now, covered by everybody. Judy Collins, who actually released it first. Frank Sinatra, Neil Diamond, Willie Nelson. I mean, she's the author of it.
Oh, it isn't Judy's. I never knew that. That one's new on me.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this one you'll probably know just because this guy is such a prolific and amazingly good writer, Bob Dylan. So most people think that, you know, Hendrix is All in the Watchtower, which is also done by Dave Mason, by the way, and he does a really good job of it. But he ought to, because he's playing the 12 string on the All Along the Watchtower, Jimi Hendrix version off Electric Ladyland. Just saying. Yeah, that's written by Bob Dylan. Hendrix also does a live version at Monterey Pop Festival and does probably the best version of the song I think I've ever heard, in my personal opinion. Turns it into a ballad, Like a Rolling Stone. And that's a Bob Dylan song. If you haven't heard that, it is It's amazing. I mean, it's jaw dropping. Forever Young, also covered by Joan Baez, Bob Dylan song. Joan Baez also covered A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which she actually played Friday. She was here in Atlanta doing her, she's doing a farewell tour, and she was really, really good, by the way. She looked awesome. She sounded great. I was very, very happy to see that. Leon Russell's also covered that song. That's a Bob Dylan song. The band doing I Shall Be Released, that's a Bob Dylan song, because they were Bob Dylan's original backup band, and that's how they got the name The Band. Peter, Paul, and Mary covering Blowing in the Wind, a Bob Dylan song. Billy Joel during his tour of Russia, The Times They Are A-Changin', Bob Dylan song. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. It was also covered by Peter, Paul, and Mary. Indigo Girls with Joan Baez later. That's also a Bob Dylan song. And the Byrds covered several Bob Dylan songs, including My Back Pages, which most people think the title is I Was So Much Older Than I'm Younger Than That Now. The name of that song is My Back Pages. Excuse me. And, of course, Mr. Tambourine, which is Man, which is what brought him to fame. And that both of those are Dylan songs. Oops. Okay, so Harrison, who has either authored or co-authored some very, very, very famous songs, amongst them Cream's Badge off Goodbye Cream record, which he co-authored with Eric Clapton. It Don't Come Easy, Ringo's song that Ringo does off one of his records, which was co-authored with Ringo. And Photograph, which was co-authored by Ringo off one of Ringo Starr's solo albums. So all those are Harrison tunes. So the song I was just playing at the intro, Snow Blind Friend, Steppenwolf did off one of their records, and The Pusher, which everybody knows Steppenwolf does. Those are both written by Hoyt Axton, who was kind of a country, Americana, acoustic guy. He was kind of a sad character. He had a major drug problem most of his life. He also penned the No No song by Ringo Starr. No, 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 I don't. No more. Right, that's Hoyt Axton's song.
Oh.
And two songs, yeah, and two songs that you will be shocked to find out. I was surprised at this one. He is the author of the two Three Dog Night songs, Never Been to Spain and Joy to the World. You know, Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Hoyt Axton. Yeah.
I had no
idea. Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, it'll blow your mind. Okay, so now let's move to the jazz and blues and NOLA sound, New Orleans. Alan Toussaint, very, very well-known, really cool, distinguished black gentleman, piano player, composer. So Rolling Stones and Who both covered a song by his called Fortune Teller. Get Out of My Life, Woman, which appeared on an early Iron Butterfly record and was covered, I think, also by Butterfield Blues Band. Working in a Coal Mine, which most people know by the 80s band Devo, was also covered by Lee Dorsey. That's an Alan Toussaint song. Southern Nights, covered by Glenn Campbell. I Like It Like That, the Dave Clark Five. I Got a Certain Girl, a certain girl. What's her name? I can't tell you, right? Warren Zevon and the Yardbirds both covered that. That's Alan Toussaint. J.J. Cale, another very unsung hero that's done a bunch of stuff, including They Call Me the Breeze, Lynyrd Skynyrd, the two songs made famous by Clapton, After Midnight and Cocaine, both penned by J.J. Cale. Kansas covering Bring It Back, also a J.J. Cale song, and Freddie King, the blues guy, covering I Got the Same Old Blues. Those are all J.J. Cale songs. Tony Joe White, Steamy Windows, Tina Turner covered it. Undercover Agent for the Blues, Tina Turner. Those are both Tony Joe White songs. Probably the two biggest ones that he's known for, the Brooke Benton song, Rainy Night in Georgia. That's Tony Joe White. And Elvis, Brooke Benton, and Tom Jones covering Poke Salad Annie. And that's a Tony Joe White song also. And Paul Williams.
Oh.
I like to refer to him the tattoo of the music world. So he has penned a lot.
Oh,
sorry.
That's not fair.
Yeah, I know. A big brat, I know. So despite what everyone thinks of his stature, he is a fabulous songwriter. He's also done a lot of acting roles, and he's not too bad as an actor, actually. So he's penned three of the famous Three Dog Night songs, including Family of Man, Out in the Country, and Old Fashioned Love Song. Those are all Paul Williams songs. You and
Wait,
Me Against the World,
and
Helen Reddy.
Old Fashioned Love Song?
Yeah, Old Fashioned Love Song. That's Paul Williams.
With Paul.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, You and Me Against the World, that was done by Helen Reddy, Paul
mm-hmm.
Williams song. Three Carpenters tunes that everybody's going to know. Rainy Days and Mondays.
Yep.
We've Only Just Begun.
Begun. Mm-hmm.
And I Won't Last a Day Without You. Those are all Paul Williams tunes.
It's pretty
David
prolific.
Bowie covering. Yeah, David Bowie covering Fill Your Head. That's a Paul Williams song. Oh, Bowie, I should say. That's the correct pronunciation of his name. And
oh.
Barbra Streisand. Yeah. And Barbra Streisand, Evergreen. The theme for Star is Born. That was Paul Williams.
Oh, wow. I love that song.
Yeah. Most people do. That's a Paul Williams tune.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy is, he's a good songwriter. There's no grass
yeah.
growing under that man's feet. He's still performing, by the way, and doing touring, which is woo for him. And finally, one last shout out. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
one last, and he's drug free now too, which is really woohoo for him. Jimmy Webb.
Oh,
and most people
okay.
know Jimmy. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just a exclamation. Very cool.
Okay,
go
so
on.
Jimmy Webb, author of The Worst That Could Happen, the old Brooklyn Bridge song. It's a
mm-hmm.
Jimmy Webb tune. Fifth Dimension song, Up, Up and Away. In My Beautiful Balloon. That's Jimmy Webb.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, I got three ones that are really going to kick in, the patooties. Glenn Campbell songs, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Galveston, and Wichita Lineman. All Jimmy Webb songs.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
And finally, my two favorites of his, Didn't We, by off Richard Harris, is an early record, Richard Harris, called Tramp of Shining. He's gone on to be a famous actor and kind of gave up the music thing, but he started out as a vocalist. Yeah, most people
know
him as Dumbledore. And, yeah. So Didn't We was a Jimmy Webb song, and probably my all-time favorite Jimmy Webb song, MacArthur Park, which is also
Whoa.
Off Richard Harris's Tramp of Shining. Yeah, there was a bet between him and Richard Harris, and Richard, because it's like an 8-minute, 7-minute song on the record. You know, it was like 68, 69, and people go, you don't do, more than three and a half minutes. I mean, what the hell? So it was the most unlikely song on the record to become gold, and I think it became platinum. And Richard Harris said, hey, if this thing goes gold, I'll buy you a Rolls Royce. So he did.
He made good on it.
Yeah, so yeah, you got to admire a man or a woman who live up to their word. You don't knock that shit. So that's my unknown songwriters that we should know, and now you do, and we can like give a shout out and a woohoo to them and thank them for all the work, because without those songs, some of those vocalists and groups would not be that well known today. So there you have it.
Very true. All right, well, thank you for that, and thank you to those guys for all their hard work. Much appreciated all around. All right, so we will again be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, here comes the meat and potatoes. So tonight's show is called Addiction is Not a Disease, Part 2. So tonight's topic, as a reminder, came up because of an old article recirculating on social media purporting that addiction is actually a brain disorder, according to the American Society of Addiction Medicine, ASAM. The article is entitled Addiction Now Defined as a Brain Disorder, Not a Behavior Issue, by the Life Science section of NBCNews.com back on August 15th of 2011. This is a debate that has been hashed and rehashed for many decades, especially since the advent of the 12-step model, which advocates confessing no power or control over one's own choices and advocating responsibility for it over to religion or a higher power. Last episode, number 66, part one of this topic, we had more to say than we had time for on our show then, so this is a continuation, picking up where we last left off. I wanted to add that many people feel they have derived some benefit from their own personal 12-step experiences, and we're not here to make anybody feel badly if it actually has been of help to you. If, however, you are in a part of your addiction recovery where you're feeling like such programs just don't ever seem to move forward or permanently address the problem, or you're put off by the notions of a higher power requirement or an oath asserting personal helplessness, then we offer information that may be of use to those who are unsatisfied with the 12-step model and are open to alternatives. Most of all, we want to be clear with our listeners that we do not see the addiction recovery process as only one way or the other, in the sense that anyone who denounces the disease model is automatically in favor of addict shaming. That is absolutely not our stance or our goal. Shame is not a successful recovery treatment in any sense under any program. We will talk tonight about choices and personal responsibility, though, and our goal is to provide viable advice and information to aid in recovery. So tonight we will pick up the last segments that we did not cover in the first part of this topic, which are, if addiction is not a disease, then what exactly is it and why? And recovery resources that support the addiction disorder model. And I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything you want to add before we get started on this.
No, I'm good, but thank you for reinforcing the fact that we are not here slamming anybody. This is not about shaming or guilting or castigating anyone. This is about informing people of the truth so they can take responsibility for their stuff, because in reality, we all are responsible for our stuff. And if we do that, it gives us the freedom to be awesome and make changes and grow, and that's what I want for every single person that I meet. And I really mean that. Yes. That is my goal.
Absolutely, and thank you for that. Okay, guys, and one more thing before we get started. We wanted to remind our listeners of other previous episodes we have done on various aspects relating to addiction, recovery, and sobriety that you may also want to check out. All our shows are listed on a pinned post at the top of our Facebook page in numeric episode order, with links directly to each individual episode, and I'm going to do these in numeric order so you'll know what you're looking for. Episode 4 was our original 12-step addiction program alternatives. It was done on September 7th of 2016, and please note this may be a bit of a repeat of tonight and last time's material, but it was one of our very first episodes, and we were still refining our format, so tonight's presentation may be a bit more structured and detailed. Episode 10, Maintaining Sobriety and Health During the Holidays. This was part 2 of a 3-part series that was December 14th of 2016. Episode 17, The Heroin Comeback, March 22nd of 2017. This is still an issue, by the way, guys. Episode 20, Medical Marijuana and the Opioid Epidemic, which was a follow-up to 17. That was May 3rd of 2017. Episode 23, Resilience. That was June 14th of 2017. I included this because it's an important tool in recovery. Recovery is a grueling process. If you are not resilient, it can wear you down, and it can make it very easy to fall away and give up. So you may want to check this out, even though it's not an addiction topic. Episode 38, Gaming Addiction. That's kind of a new thing in the arena, so it's not mentioned everywhere. That's January 24th, 2018, last year. Episode 57, Setting Boundaries on Holidays, November 28th, 2018. I included because setting boundaries is another good tool you guys might want. Episode 62, The Stigma of Mental Health Labels, February 6th, 2019. Another relevant tool, dealing with labels. That's one reason people don't always go for help. They're worried about getting a label like addict and then people, you know, fixating on that and mistreating them. Episode 63, Responsibility, Accountability, Blame, and Change, February 20th, 2019, another good tool, dealing with the differences between these. Episode 66, last time, Addiction is Not a Disease, that was from April 3rd, and that's the companion episode to this one. Okay, here we go. So the first part is, if addiction is not a disease, then what exactly is it and why? So in our last episode, we already defined what is a disease and why addictions do not qualify as such. And if you guys want to get into that in detail, then feel free to go listen. Addictions of all the various types have been classified as disorders pretty much since the DSM and the ICD standards have been in use. Neither reference book has ever classified any form of addiction as a disease, and the psychological and psychiatric professional communities remain in consensus about this stance. So, what is a disorder in the mental health sense? My source for this particular version is from verywellmind.com. A psychological disorder, also known as a mental disorder, is a pattern of behavioral or psychological symptoms that impact multiple life areas and create distress for the person experiencing these symptoms. The latest edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Manual, the DSM-5, defines a mental disorder as, quote, a syndrome characterized by a clinically significant disturbance in an individual's cognitive, emotion regulation, or behavior that reflects a dysfunction in the psychological, biological, or developmental process underlying mental functioning. Mental disorders are usually associated with significant distress in social, occupational, or other important activities, end quote. The DSM-5 also notes that expected responses to a common stressor, such as the death of a loved one, are not considered mental disorders. The diagnostic manual also suggests that behaviors that are often considered at odds with social norms are not considered disorders unless these actions are the result of some dysfunction. You know, that somebody is just eccentric, for example. Another version of this definition, this was an earlier proposal before they had codified the DSM definition. This was notes on this, and I wanted to read this different version. This will give you an idea of the views of the psychological community on the definition and aspects that were not mentioned above. So aspect, they're lettered A, B, C, D, but I'm just going to go ahead and read them in order. So one, a behavioral or psychological syndrome or pattern that occurs in an individual, the consequences of which are clinically significant distress, for example, a painful symptom, or a disability, for example, impairment in one or more important areas of functioning, must not be merely an expectable response to common stressors and losses, for example, loss of a loved one, or a culturally sanctioned response to a particular event, for example, trance states in religious rituals, that reflects an underlying psychobiological dysfunction that is not solely the result of social deviance or conflicts with society, that has diagnostic validity using one or more sets of diagnostic validators, for example, prognostic significance, psychobiological disruption, response to treatment, that has clinical utility, for example, contributes to better conceptualization of diagnoses or to better assessment and treatment. And I'm going to stop here and see if Dr. Mathis wants to add anything before I go to the next part.
No, that's pretty right on.
That's spot on. Okay. So the next little bit was a question that I wanted to poke the bear with a little bit. Addictive personality. So there's a common pop culture trope about how some people just genetically are, quote, born with an addictive personality, which is held up as proof that it is as much a disease as MS or cancer. So Dr. Mathis, this question is for you. Is an addictive personality still considered a valid diagnosis of any kind, or was it ever? Could you explain to our listeners how this notion is or is not valid?
Yeah, that's a very easy concept, actually. And I think this is one that the bear would not mind being poked. Yeah, he would probably say, imagine the plausibilities.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, you don't have any kids. You're not allowed to make puns. You're not a dad.
Okay. I know. That was kind of fur out, right? Okay.
Oh,
shut
the heck
up and
answer the question.
This is
why you call your guitars your babies, because you want an excuse for
yeah.
puns.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So that really, in all seriousness, that really was a very good question. It has never been, there's never been a diagnosis or a personality disorder known as addictive personality ever. That's never been considered. What is the case is that some people come with a genetic makeup that makes them more susceptible to become, for them to evolve and to adopt various personality disorders, whether they're depressive or anxiety disordered or personality disordered or have a substance dependency disorder. Okay? So just because you have, let's say you come out of the chute and you're a shyer, more introverted person, which we know is in part a birth thing, a genetic thing, and you also have less resiliency than the next person that coming down the chute, and we also know that tends to be kind of an inborn thing. And then you get surrounded by a very abusive, confrontational environment. And because you don't have the resiliency, as Shakespeare would say, to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, you decompensate, you break down, you get more agitated more easily, right? And therefore, you sometimes will try to cope by blocking things out. And for some people, that means willing to result in going for substances for immediate gratification to make themselves feel good or to escape and avoid and numb out the pain that they're experiencing, emotional pain. That's true for physical pain too, but more so for emotional pain. So certain folks certainly have less brownie points coming out of the chute. But just because they have that, just because their parents are addicts, just because they get surrounded by addiction behaviors, and just because it's reinforced in their socioeconomic status or in their culture, or let's say they play in a rock band, it's definitely reinforced in that environment, right? Let's say they also have, you know, some physical problems that they're, you know, upset about or sick of, and it causes them to feel shame about their bodies or about the fact that they are sick all the time and they can't participate in sports or the same things that their peer group can, so they're feeling very down on themselves, right? These are markers for things that will lead some folks to resort to drugs as a way to cope with them with those things. But not everybody does that. Right, and you're listening to one for whom that was the case, and you know my history, and you know most of the listeners probably don't. But the short version is, when I came out of the chute, my mom's milk dried up, and that was back in the day before they knew to supplement with other things if that is the case. So I basically had no immune system, or a very damaged immune system. So from age 2 to age 10, I was in the hospital every year for 3 months. Lived on antibiotics. I'm allergic to both penicillin and sulfa drugs. So I have to take the mycin drugs, which are less efficacious, which means you're taking more of them for longer periods of time, which means it's thinning your blood out and increasing your white blood cells, your leukocytes, to fight off the infections. But because that, it does that at the expense of the red blood cells, which means you're not having as much iron and oxygen and nutrients, and so you're tired all the time. And because I lived on all these medications all the time at such a young age, by the time I turned 10, my metabolism shut down because of all the side effects of all the medication. They irritated my stomach. I either had diarrhea or vomiting or whatever. And so around 10 years old, and because of that, I never ate a whole lot. I never ate more than a couple of meals a day. I was never a 3-meal, 4-meal-a-day kind of guy. And by the time I was age 10 or 11, I was, you know, down to about 1 meal a day, but my metabolism shut down, and I put on a boatload of weight. And so by the time I was 14, I weighed 230 pounds and had a 44, 46-inch waist and could not get the weight off no matter what the hell I did. So if you don't think I had no self-esteem, you're crazy. And the fact that I was 2 years ahead of everybody in class and I had this huge IQ and, you know, and all meant nothing to me because I was this fat piece of you-know-what. And this is my own self-evaluation. Because of my being a perfectionist, I was beating the shit out of myself constantly. I couldn't play sports. I couldn't go out and expose. I mean, every time I'd go outdoors, I would get well. I'd go outdoors, and some aberrant bug would go around, and I'd be sick, and it'd be another 6 weeks of medication. And I was being inside, wrapped up, mama's little boy. I mean, it was really horrible. And about age 10, I started playing guitar as a way to distance myself from the bullshit. Right, and then I got good on guitar, and then I started playing in bands. Well, since I was this big fat kid, everybody thought I was older than I was, and so I was playing out with older musicians, and, you know, I was exposed to all these drugs. Addictions were on both sides of my family. My father's family are basically a bunch of lushes and not very nice people and personality disordered folks to cluster bees. my mom's people have the sleep disorder that I inherited, thank you very much, and they, because of that, they tried to put themselves to sleep and wake up, so they were sedative hypnotic addicts and analgesic painkillers, narcotic painkillers, heroin addicts, and you know, opioids and all that kind of stuff, because that's secondary side effects of knocking you out. But then you have to take amphetamines in the daytime because you have daytime sedation. So I'm looking on one side of the family going, okay, a bunch of drug addicts over here, a bunch of drunks over here. Okay, drugs are bad. Okay, I get it. And I made a decision at 8 or 9 years old, I was never going to do that shit, and I never have, ever. And nobody was more miserable than I have. I was. Nobody. Nobody had a lower sense of self. Nobody beat the shit out of themselves more than I did. Nobody was more unhappy and depressed than I was as a kid because of that fact. And I never turned to drugs, ever. So, on your disease theory, because the gene runs on both sides of my family. And I got the gene. What I chose to do was not enact the gene. It's a choice. You have a choice. You always flip and have a choice. What's much more of a disease is ADHD. Because if you're born with that gene, the ADHD gene, you're going to have ADHD. It's just a matter of how much of it you're going to have, and do you have compensation tools to avert it, which most folks do not. So that's much more about, quote-unquote, disease than addiction ever thought of being. Or depression ever thought of being. Only about 5 to 10% of all depressed people have dysfunctional brains coming out of the chute, and therefore they have the quote-unquote disease of the, they have a malfunctioning serotonin system. And, you know, you don't really have a choice about that if you come out of the chute with that. That's certain forms, very limited forms of depression, are much more diseases than addictions ever thought of being, ever. So it's a choice. You make a choice to use drugs to either make yourself feel better or to escape and avoid, knock yourself out of what you're doing. It's immediate gratification, right? And I knew no matter how miserable I was that if I took drugs, I was just eventually that was going to make me more miserable. I used to joke about it being a short-term gain, and I put that in quotes, short-term gains for long-term pains. You know, you're going to feel better right now, but at some point, point down the road, it's going to kick your assets. You're going to pay the price. So, yeah. No, it is not. And so there are certain constellations, trait characteristics that will make you more susceptible to that. If you have an external locus of control, if you are more prone to see your life as a leaf in the wind blowing and you don't have any control over it, and you abrogate control over your life as opposed to having an internal locus of control, you're the captain of your own ship and you know, you're the master or mistress of the boat, and you get to choose where you go and what you do, internal locus of control, which I am definitely that. You know, some of those things, but if you know that, and if you know you're sick, and you know you have these issues, you know you have depression, and it's pretty obvious if you're a kid and you're miserable, you know there's something wrong. You may not have a label for it, but you know there's something wrong. I mean, it's really flipping obvious. You just do something about it that's helpful as opposed to hurtful. And that's really the bottom line. And most people that become addicted or use drugs for a long time make the wrong choice. It's an inappropriate choice to try to cope with the stuff they're going through, right? It's just a wrong choice. And every one of us has made mistakes and wrong choices, so I'm not slamming any of those folks at all. You know, I just have the wherewithal to not do that. And, you know, and both and my father would have been a big practicing addict had my mom not harassed the shit out of him, because I remember him drinking beers and doing all these crazy things, and I'm just like, no, I'm not doing that shit. That's dumber than dog poop. I'm not doing it. So I learned by example. Other people go, cool, and go, you know, how come I went, no, that's ridiculous. And other people go, cool, I want to do that too. Well, it's just because you make a choice because you decide one thing's cool and one thing's not. That's not a disease. That you being a dumbass, no offense, and in some cases not knowing any better. But it doesn't matter. All of this is a choice, because even if you buy, okay, it's a disease, you have the gene, it makes you much more likely to use drugs. Okay, great. How do you activate the gene? How do you make the gene expressed? Oh, you start using drugs. Oh, does the disease model say you have to start using drugs? No, 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 no. It says once you start and you cross the line, you can't go back. Well, who started it? You did. You're still responsible. Boom. End of story. Not a disease. No.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. So the next part that I want to get to is types of psychological disorders as per the DSM-5. And the following article just came out last month and lists a basic summary of categories of conditions or pathologies that are enumerated in the DSM-5. And my purpose in including this list is for our listeners to understand the types of conditions that generally do comprise bona fide mental health issues, as well as to see why these conditions would be disorders rather than diseases. And this is from a list of psychological disorders by Kendra Cherry. It was medically reviewed by a board-certified physician. It was written March 30th, 2019 at verywellmind.com. And she says, while not a comprehensive list of every mental disorder, the following list includes some of the major categories of disorders described in the DSM-5. The latest edition was released in May of 2013. Okay, so there are 12 categories here. I'm going to read off to you guys. Try to do this quick because we want to make sure that we get all this in for you. All right, first one is neurodevelopmental disorders. And neurodevelopmental disorders are those disorders that are typically diagnosed during infancy, childhood, or adolescence. Obviously, as the name implies, stuff that happens while you're developing. Two, bipolar and related disorders. Bipolar disorder is characterized by shifts in mood as well as changes in activity and energy levels. Three, anxiety disorders. Anxiety disorders are those characterized by excessive and persistent fear, worry, anxiety, and related behavioral disturbances. Fear involves an emotional response to a threat, whether that threat is real or perceived. Anxiety involves the anticipation that a future threat may arrive. Four, trauma and stressor-related disorders. Trauma and stressor-related disorders involve the exposure to a stressful or traumatic event. These were previously grouped with the anxiety disorders, but are now considered a distinct category of disorders of their own. Dissociative disorders.
There's not disassociative, it's dissociative, just FYI.
Oh, dissociative. Okay.
Ding, ding, we have a winner.
Yay. I don't want to pronounce that. Okay. They are psychological disorders that involve dissociation or interruption in aspects of consciousness, including identity and memory, like DID, which was called MPD, et cetera. Six, somatic symptom and related disorders. Formerly referred to under the heading of somatoform disorders, this category is now known as somatic symptoms and related disorders. Somatic symptom disorders are a class of psychological disorders that involve prominent physical symptoms that may not have a diagnosable physical cause. It's really kind of a blanket term, and they have a catch-all, and there's no way to summarize what
they use it for. So just to give listeners an idea, an example of that is conversion disorder. So if somebody has a headache or a stomach ache or these vague symptoms that are a result of them being depressed or stressed, and they don't have an exception they're depressed or stressed, and they don't have any bona fide organic biological cause for that, but their emotions run away with them. They change their brain's neurology and neurochemistry, and then the muscles and organs react. And so they're real physical symptoms, but they're physical symptoms coming out of emotional distress.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for expounding on that.
Sure.
Okay. So number seven, feeding and eating disorders. Eating disorders are characterized by obsessive concerns with weight and disruptive eating patterns that negatively impact physical and mental health. Sleep-wake disorders. Sleep disorders involve an interruption in sleep patterns that lead to distress and affect daytime functioning. Sleep disorders related to other mental disorders as well as sleep disorders relating to general medical conditions have been removed from the DSM-5. The latest edition also provides more emphasis on coexisting conditions for each of the sleep-wake disorders. Disruptive impulse control and conduct disorders. Impulse control disorders are those that involve an inability to control emotions and behaviors resulting in harm to oneself or to others. And then substance-related and addictive disorders, and that relates to tonight's topic. Substance-related disorders are those that involve the use and abuse of different substances such as cocaine, methamphetamine, opiates, and alcohol. These disorders may include substance-induced conditions that can result in many associated diagnoses, including intoxication, withdrawal, the emergence of psychosis, anxiety, and delirium. Notice the word that's not in there, disease. The last two are neurocognitive disorders, which are characterized by acquired deficits in cognitive function. These disorders do not include those in which impaired cognition was present at birth or early in life. And the last one is personality disorders, which are characterized by an enduring pattern of maladaptive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that can cause serious detriments to relationships and other life areas. I'm going to check in with you real quick, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to add in here.
No, that was good.
Okay. So the next part, if you guys are not writing stuff down, you may want to download the episode or bookmark the episode and go back, because there's info in here that if you are dealing with addiction, there's resources and names and websites and stuff that can help you out. So we feel that we've made a clear and compelling case for framing addiction as a disorder rather than a disease. So having said that, where does this leave us? Listeners who are ready to shift their approach are going to need addiction support networks that are in alignment with this stance, rather than the flawed and outdated 12-step model that permeates our society and judicial system. So this section is recovery resources that support the addiction disorder model. Okay, so here are some organizations that are more secular in nature and founded in actual science. And the source for this list is AmericanAddictionCenters.org. And this list is available on many addiction-related sites these days. These are like the top five. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health, NSDUH, reports that more than 20 million American adults aged 12 and older, for this purpose, adults, struggle with a substance use disorder related to drug or alcohol abuse. And the results are from the 2014 National Survey on Drug Use and Health done by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, which is an organization we've mentioned on previous episodes. Some common alternatives to 12-step programs include, and this list was last updated February 14, 2019, LifeRing Secular Recovery. They're at lifering.org. Moderation Management, which is a non-abstinence model, for those of you who are interested in that, they're at moderation.org. Secular Organizations for Sobriety, SOS. And they are at sossobriety.org. Self-Management and Recovery Training, SMART Recovery. And they are at smartrecovery.org. And Women for Sobriety at womenforsobriety.org. Additionally, one of the first such programs not mentioned in the above list is Rational Recovery, at rational.org. The SMART program I mentioned above was a splinter off from RR starting in 93, and in 99, RR moved away from in-person group meetings, which tended to reduce the number of participants in its program. It is still in existence at this time, and you'll hear it mentioned a lot, but it has a much smaller footprint these days. If you're looking for RR or their style, then you probably are going to want to chase up SMART, Self-Management Recovery Training, smartrecovery.org. But any of the five at the top that I've mentioned could be of help. Couple other additional programs that are outside the 12-step model that we do not encourage, but I wanted to inform our listeners of these programs so that you hopefully steer clear, because you may see them in Google searches or whatever if you're looking for non-12-step programs, and they are Narconon International, which is run by the Church of Scientology these days, and it is not based on any actual science, at least not the version that they are doing now. And then Refuge Recovery, which was run by Buddhist Noah Levine of Santa Cruz, California. In February 2019, just several weeks ago, he was found likely guilty of sexual harassment of practitioners by investigators from Against the Stream Meditation Society, ATS, and Refuge Recovery. And Spirit Rock Meditation Center's Ethics and Reconciliation Council rescinded his authority to teach and the centers have closed. Now, understand this was not a court case. This was basically the Buddhist organization sponsoring his facility basically said he's not a teacher affiliated with them anymore because they said there likely was cause for his accusations. So if you see either of these two organizations mentioned anywhere as a referral, we do not recommend them. And I have also a list of writers and others who are doing work that, and this is a reading list, so get ready to take notes. And I'm going to give you guys the names of some authors of books and papers that are considered cornerstones of non-12-step recovery methods. So be sure to write these names down and look up their work online and at your libraries. Okay. So first is Albert Ellis, PhD. He invented rational emotive behavior therapy. Archie Brodsky, B-R-O-D-S-K-Y. He is the author of multiple anti-12-step books. Charles, usually goes by Chaz, C-H-A-Z. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's B-U-F-E. I don't know if he pronounces the E. He's an anarchist author and has done numerous atheist writings and critiques of AA and the 12-step model. Herbert Fingeret, PhD. He's also a critic of the disease model of addiction. Joyce H. Lowinson, L-O-W-I-N-S-O-N, M.D. She's a professor emerita at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in NYC. Lance M., and I'm going to ask you again to correct me with the pronunciation of his last name, if you would, Dr. Mathis, D-O-D-E-S?
Dodds.
Dodds, thank you. And Zachary Dodds wrote The Sober Truth, which is an extensive debunking of the AA model. Stanton Peel, P-E-E-L-E, psychologist, and Archibald Brodsky that we mentioned earlier, love relationship addiction work that they did. Vince Fox, who is affiliated with Rational Recovery that I mentioned earlier, and W.R. Nay, N-A-Y, and George R. Ross, who have done a lot of stuff on adolescent drug abuse work. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else you want to add on that.
Yeah, excuse me. Herbert Fingeret did the study. So the short version is a case went before the United States Supreme Court by a patient who was denied services by the VA, because he says, hey, you know, you got to take me in your program. I have a disease. And then the VA, who uses the disease model, said basically, screw you. You've been here 35 times. You just want three hots and a cot. We have other people who really want help. We're not taking you. The case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and they hired a research team headed by Herbert Fingeret and a bunch of other people. I think Stanton Peel was involved. And basically, to look at the last 50 years, this happened in 88, 89, look at the last 40, 50 years of the real empirical research on addictions to discern, are they really diseases or not? And they came back with a resounding, never have been, never will be, aren't now. And the guy lost his case. And you can imagine the uproar that caused in the 12-step community. So he has really been a pioneer. A lot of his work was based on and inspired by someone that you ought to also mention, Alan Marlatt. Who was a Canuck, who came over to this country and was teaching at Washington University in Seattle, and he has authored hundreds of books and articles and research studies on the fallacy of the 12 steps and has done all kind of research stuff back in the 60s and 70s that probably wouldn't get past the committee today, including putting sugar water in front of a bunch of addicts, and they drank it, and then you told them it was alcohol, and they all had, quote-unquote, relapse experiences, and they had, you know, oh, my God, you know. And he goes, chill, dudes, it was sugar water. No, I know you gave us alcohol, oh, my God. Yeah, right. And he was able, the past few years ago, but he has hundreds of pieces of work out there. The guy was really, really on his game, and has been saying it since the 60s, this was a bunch of bunk. So a lot of these folks were inspired by and used Alan Marlatt's seminal work in the field. And he was a psychology person. No.
Do you remember how to spell his name for those who might be writing this down?
I think it's A-L-A-N-M-A-R-L-A-T-T, I think. I am the world's worst speller, so.
That's okay. A lot of times Google will pick it up and correct you.
R-O-R on that one, which is Asian for rots a ruck, because, you know, my spelling skills are, like, bad. But I think that's the correct spelling of his name.
Fair enough. Okay. So, in summary, it's been a long, convoluted, and contentious process in evolving the arena of addiction and recovery services. The 12-step programs, being one of the first, is the most ubiquitous and well-known, but it is fraught with flaws that severely impugn its ability to actually help people recover. We hope our listeners will be able to use suggested alternative resources as needed to help themselves in a more effective manner. So this is going to effectively wrap up our show, part two, Addiction is Not a Disease. So Dr. Mathis, is there anything that you want to add in closing?
All I'll say is anybody is going to go for treatment, excuse me, call around. If you're going to go for individual therapy or you're going to go to a program, most programs are 12-step based, so it's going to be very difficult to find one that isn't. You may have to resort to going to an individual clinician and getting real therapy, individual outpatient. There are some folks who do aggressive outpatient, which means you can meet with them, you know, 2, 3, 5 times a week if you want. Those folks are few and far between, but they are out there. When you call for services, whether it's from a psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, whatever, addictions counselor, whatever, and some of us wear multiple hats. So most of our listeners probably know by now that I'm board certified addictionologist as well as a psychologist. So I do two things in one. So when people call in, you know, ask what their orientation is, ask how they work with addicts, ask whether they do assessments. The same thing you would ask for a therapist. You know, what's your theoretical field? Do you do aggressive outpatient? Do you make house calls, which very few people do? I do, but, you know, I'm weird and a masochist, so what do I know? But in all seriousness, I make house calls and I do aggressive outpatient, and as you know, I work 7 days a week. Saturday and Sunday are common days for me to work. So ask what their operating hours, ask what their emergency procedure is. If somebody has a relapse and has to see them on the spot, can they accommodate that? You know, do they support the use of medication or not, which I am completely opposed to try to remain abstinent, which I think is a huge ass mistake. But if they do, and then you want to do that, you need to know that. And, you know, do they liaison with physicians? Do they have liaisons with hospitals in case of emergency? You need to find out all that kind of stuff before you go into treatment. Don't just go looking people up and believe the hype you hear. You know, talk to the clinician himself or herself or to their office manager or nurse, practitioner, or whomever is in the office to do that. And a general rule of thumb is if you don't hear back from them in a day or two, call somebody else. That shows you what a slack ass they are. No offense, but that's like ridiculous. And I can't tell you how many hundreds of stories I've heard of that. So don't be afraid to ask questions, and don't be afraid to, you know, be very active in finding somebody that you can trust. And then if you go in and you don't jive with them, find somebody else. Find somebody you can trust that you jive with, that you are going to have a one-on-one, because you're going to be in, you know, somebody who's really going to do their job. You're going to be very intimate with them in an appropriate way, obviously. I'm not meaning to imply something funky. You know, and it's going to require you trusting them and being honest and open in the whole nine yards. So, you know, do your homework and advocate for yourself, and don't stop till you find somebody that works.
Yes, fair enough. Okay, so on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, May 1st at 11 p.m. EDT right here on blogtalkradio.com. Our own upcoming show topics will include Wednesday, May 1st, episode 68. The topic is grieving, loss, mourning, and closure. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Thursday the 18th at 8 p.m. EDT, Travelitch Radio, to mark next year's 400th anniversary of the Mayflower in 1620, a myriad special events are planned in New England over the next 2 years. Find out more on Travelitch Radio when Dan Schlossberg and co-host Anita Stokes-Thomas interview Michelle Pecoraro of Plymouth 400, one of several organizations promoting the festivities. Monday the 22nd at 11 a.m., Branson, Missouri has reinvented itself as arguably the greatest entertainment venue in the country. Attractions range from theme park rides to theater operated by the biggest names in show business. Branson today is family friendly with something for everyone of every age. Monday, May 7th at 10 p.m. EDT, Monday Night in America. The Admiral returns to Monday nights with Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega. And Sunday, June 2nd at 8:30 p.m. EDT, Fear Walking Dead online viewing party that is hosted by yours truly. Season 5, Episode 1 opener title to be announced. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.